Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do human beings kill other human beings? While survival in the natural world requires some species to prey on others, surprisingly few of them systematically band together to kill their own. But that behavior occurs regularly in both chimpanzees and human beings. My guest today says our drive to team up and do battle is rooted deep within our genetic heritage, but reminds us that those instincts evolved at a time when our ancestors used their own bodies to maim and kill others, rather than weapons that could be launched from a distance to kill thousands or millions in a single act. Malcolm Potts is an obstetrician, research scientist, and Fred H. Bixby Professor at the University of California at Berkeley. His book, written with science journalist Thomas Hayden, is called Sex and War: How Biology Explains Warfare and Terrorism and Offers a Path to a Safer World. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. Malcolm, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me here.
Talk about how your work treating patients in conflict zones got you to start thinking about this.
In 1972, there was a terrible war between what was then called East and West Pakistan, and tens of thousands of women were deliberately raped. And I led a small team of doctors from various countries, obviously including Bangladesh itself, to try and help those women. It was the most harrowing experience of my life. Mm-hmm. Many of the women, you know, were 12, 14 years old. They didn't talk to each other. They just lay like logs because they were destroyed. This was a Muslim country where in the war they'd killed the men and raped the women. And I was a small child myself in the beginning of World War II. My elder brother was a professional soldier, fought in Korea. And I think the older I get, one asks, why do human beings do this? Why is warfare so ubiquitous and going all the way back through our history?
And are we, in fact, wired for violence?
I think we're wired for what we call team aggression. Mm-hmm. And that this goes back to a common ancestor of chimpanzees about 7 million years ago. And males would gather together, and chimpanzees, like human beings, are territorial, leave the territory in which they live, go out into another territory, find an isolated individual and attack that individual in the most vicious way possible, tearing off strips of flesh with their canine teeth, twisting limbs out of their sockets. And a third of adult chimpanzees are killed by other chimpanzees. Hmm. Now, I know Jane Goodall, and I've been lucky enough to watch her chimpanzees. I haven't seen them do this. It's a very rare event. But over time, if this just happens, you know, once or twice a year, and perhaps 40 animals in a troop, it has an enormous difference. So in our book, we began with what chimpanzees do, and we asked, well, what does archaeology and anthropology and written history tell us? Are human beings behaving in the same way? And I think the evidence is that we are.
And part of the reason for this, I suppose, would be that the more other people or other chimpanzees that you kill, the more resources there are available for your little band.
That's right. Evolution is a therefore, not a because. Mm-hmm. Mutations are not what is good or right or honorable. It's what works. And those animals, those that had the mutation to go out and kill other animals of the same species, got more space, they got more food resources, they could have more females, they left more genes in the next generation. And sadly, that is how Darwinian evolution used to judge how we work. I don't think it does today. And I want to emphasize, and I think I'll do this many times, Chris, that we don't have to do these terrible things. But I think trying to get insight into why we've done them helps us confront some of these horrors and may help us make the world a safer place.
Do chimps who wage aggressive attacks on outsiders also rape?
Or if there's No, they don't. It's very interesting.
Sometimes
these raids, they bring back a female and may coerce her. I suppose you'd call that rape. Also, the females, I think, see that if their troop is diminishing in numbers, it may be a wise choice to go and join the other ones. Mm-hmm. And I think when we were writing the book, I would say something to my wife, you know, this is what human beings do. And she said, no, it's not what human beings do, it's what males do. Hmm. And I think a very important takeaway message is that this is a male behavior that never benefited females. And in the whole of human history, we were unable to find any single instance where women spontaneously banded together and went out to kill other human beings. Women will fight very bravely when they're threatened. They'll fight to protect their children. They may go with male warriors because that may be a good choice about where resources are, but they don't do this spontaneously. I think that's a very important message.
Our other closest relative, evolutionarily, is the bonobo, yeah, which does not have an aggressive streak.
No, it's Panpaniscus is another species of chimpanzee, and you're absolutely right. They have an enormous amount of sex, which they use in various ways. The Jane Goodall chimpanzees live in forests where there used to be gorillas, so the chimps eat the fruit and the gorillas eat the leaves. Where the bonobos live, there aren't any gorillas, so the bonobos eat the fruit and the leaves. They have a better diet, and they go around in larger groups. And I think it's partly that you don't get isolated individuals which a raid could kill. It may also be that they do have this different behavior. And females, in the bonobos, the females make same-sex sexual relationships. And two females, although they're smaller than a male, can beat up on a male. Mm-hmm. In the chimpanzees that my wife and I have seen, Jane Goodall's chimps in Gombe Park in Tanzania, the males are bigger than the females, and they're always showing off. They just sort of hit the females, showing that they can dominate them. And so this same-sex behavior between the females produces an emotional bond which enables them to keep the males in control. So it's a much more peaceful society when females can keep males in control, and perhaps Homo sapiens should learn that.
Yeah, that's absolutely something that we can, I suppose, extrapolate. And in fact, in societies, human societies, where women's sexuality is considered either threatening or wrong in some way or unnatural even, there's more violence.
Absolutely. So in a society like northern Nigeria, where we're working, the mean age of marriage is 14 years. It's a polygamous society. Men are marrying these, you know, third or fourth wives when they're 40 years old. There can never be any sensible emotional relationship, which we would expect in a heterosexual loving relationship in this kind of society. And, we're very interested as to how to raise the age of marriage in these groups. Or in Afghanistan, you've got a similar situation, a polygamous society, the older men having the young virgins. And when you have very rapid population growth, then you have many more 14-year-old virgins than you have 40-year-old men, and that sort of plays into their hands. And so one of our takeaway messages is that if you want to make the world a safer place, you need to encourage the autonomy of women and give them the knowledge and technologies where they can have the number of children they want and not the number of children that they don't want, which is what's happening at present.
What's so interesting about that is that it goes beyond simply competition for resources. No. It's not only that a large population is going to be necessarily poor and then fighting for things.
Yeah, it's partly the population structure. When you have when you've got a lot of young testosterone-filled men in the 15 to 30-year-old age group, that is really the warrior age group. Those are the brave men that ran up Omaha Beach. Those are the men that fought at the Battle of Marathon. They're in that age group. That's where most of the casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan in our present wars are coming from. When you have a large number of those men that are not employed and not educated, then they get very, very angry. And the 9/11 Commission said that one of the things that creates sort of social turmoil is a large number of young men who are not employed, uneducated, and who can't make sexual relationships. These are sexually conservative societies. So they're extraordinarily angry, and they will go with any fundamentalist political or religious group. And if I was in that age group and I was in the same situation, I have to be honest, I would do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting reading about that in the book and then thinking about Tunisia, where the whole conflict started with one unemployed man.
Yes, exactly. And then the other men joined in. And in a way, what's happening in North Africa is encouraging. Tunisia is one country where women have had a good deal of autonomy since President Bougueiba gave them that, and they got rid of the veil. And the family size is now very low. Abortion's legal in Tunisia. Family planning's available. I've worked there, and I've got great admiration for what they've done. So they were able to overthrow a despot and yet not turn to very violent means. If the same thing had happened in Afghanistan, then they'd been blowing each other up because you've got an even more rapid population growth.
So you talked earlier about the reality that, you know, 15 to 30-year-old men are the most aggressive among the men that we have. I'm curious about, you know, now with the way that world demographics are changing, in much of the developing world, population is skewed toward much younger people.
Yes.
In much of the developed world, suddenly we have
exactly.
much larger populations
yes.
of older people. What does that mean for our future?
I think it means that we've got a larger population of older people. You'll have a more peaceful, less volatile situation. Young people in the right situation are incredibly creative. I mean, the Beatles wrote their best songs when they were in that age group. Einstein did his best work when he was in that age group. So it's what we want is to slow population growth so that men in that age group can be creative and not get them into the situation where it drives violence.
The other point that you make is that in the, say, the Stone Age, overreacting to perceived threats actually yeah. probably served us quite well.
Yes. And I think we overreacted in a way to 9/11. I think that every decade or so, angry people in other countries will try and do something bad to us, and they probably will succeed. As I said, in the chimpanzees, about a third of adults are killed by other chimps. In what we call pre-literate societies, like people living in the Stone Age in New Guinea, a third of adults are killed by other human beings. In the Civil War, 2% of Americans died. Mm-hmm. In World War II, 1 in 300 died. In 9/11, 1 in 100,000. Now, it was a terrible attack, and I'm not trying to diminish it, but it wasn't something to panic over. And rather, what we have to do is to look upstream and say, how can we stop young men hating us and banding together in order to do nasty things to us? Because this was a band like a chimpanzee band. It was 19 young men in this age group. Two of them were brothers. And they believed they were doing something noble. They believed that this is what they should do. Remember, a terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And one of the things we have to do is to put ourselves in the shoes of these people that are attacking us and saying, what can we do to make the world a safer place? Because merely firing back at them is not going to work. First of all, we can't find them. We can't find Osama bin Laden to right. fire back at him. We've got to look at what's going to make a society like Afghanistan or Pakistan or the Yemen more gentle. How are we going to give women autonomy? How are we going to offer them family planning so they can have the children they want? And so we slow population growth.
Are you confident that our genes respond to logic?
I think we can control our predispositions. Mm-hmm. We can, young men love to have football matches. It's a sort of ritualized fight. We're not intending to kill each other. We can take something which, if it's uncontrolled, is highly destructive and could destroy civilization and make it into something which is either fun or something that's creative. And that's the challenge that faces us, and I think the one we need to think about very deeply.
What about situations where women are in power, either as Secretary of State or as President or Prime Minister of particular countries? In many cases in modern history, we've seen them making choices much more like their male counterparts. Do women in positions of power become more like men?
I think it's a good point, Chris. I think what happened with people like Margaret Thatcher is the first people who get to the top in what's been a previously male occupation tend to be rather competitive females. And so it's not having one person like Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan. It's having a lot of women in parliament like Sweden does or Rwanda does now. I think we should have many. America has fewer people in Congress than we were recommending to Iraq to have women in their parliament. So, and we want more women in legislatures and more women in power and more women, if I may say so, Chris, like you, that are leading programs and talking about these issues. Because, you know, I tell my wife, if we could get into each other's brains for 20 minutes, we'd be astonished as to how different the world looks if you've got a male brain or a female brain.
My guest is obstetrician and research scientist Malcolm Potts. His book is called Sex and War, How Biology Explains Warfare and Terrorism. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. He's Malcolm Potts, an obstetrician, research scientist, and Fred H. Bixby professor at UC Berkeley. His book, written with science journalist Thomas Hayden, is called Sex and War: How Biology Explains Warfare and Terrorism and Offers a Path to a Safer World. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the line to Janelle in Dallas. Hi, Janelle.
Yes, hi, Chris. I had a question. I was wondering, with the age of the males being the most active, is most aggressive, 15 to 35, is there any chance that, like, we can do some kind of early development training to help them get past this this tribe mentality, and I guess help all of us to see each other more as instead of individual tribes, to see us as one unity?
Thanks for your call.
I think that's a very good question, and I have to repeat many times, while I think, you know, we have a genetic predisposition to be violent, we don't have to be, and there's very good evidence that if little boys have good parenting, they're much less likely to grow into violent individuals. If they are violently treated as children, then they're more likely to be violent adults. And so there's a lot we can do, I think, and which we have to do to make ourselves, to use the appropriate word, more civilized.
What explains societies that have not developed particularly violent tendencies? One thing that you write about here is the development, early development of projectile weapons.
Yes, I mean, once we had this predisposition, when we invented bows and arrows and eventually atomic bombs, then it was much easier to kill people. Going back to the chimpanzees, chimpanzees are very tough animals. I once saw one fall about 20 feet out of a tree. I thought it had broken every bone in its body. It got up and shook itself. So in these attacks, they often take a day or two to die. And probably our hominid ancestors were fighting with their fists and things for millions of years. And then once we got our projectiles and things, then we became much more dangerous. Or in New Zealand, the Maoris were a very warlike group of people. They literally had bows and arrows. Once they got muskets in the 19th century, which they got from the whalers, they almost exterminated each other. Mm-hmm. And so I think we live in a dangerous time. We all have now weapons of mass destruction. Pakistan's got a large number of nuclear weapons, and Pakistan, I think, is one of the most dangerous countries in the world. I have many friends there that I respect, and I think they would agree with me. It's got rapid population growth. The young men are not well educated, and they don't have any employment. It's a sexually conservative society. They're very angry, and if Pakistan broke up, then they'd sell their weapons to Al-Qaeda. In Libya, we were stupid enough to sell heat-seeking guided missiles to the Libyans. Now Libya's in chaos. Those missiles could go to Al-Qaeda or somebody else and bring down civil airliners. One thing we need to learn is not to sell our sophisticated weapons to any unstable society. And we've been doing that. Never sell it to anybody except another democracy.
And part of the problem is that our ancestors, when they decided to band together and engage in battle, there was a sort of a direct man-to-man calculus concerning the risk to one individual.
Yes.
In taking on another. Whereas here, you can have, as you mentioned earlier, that band of 19 young men taking at least 3,000 lives.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, warfare, I mean, we all respect courage. I mean, we give people medals of honor, and I think we should do. And so this team aggression does depend upon people originally being genetically related to each other or perceiving themselves to be genetically related, which is what the boot camp does to people. And so you are willing to die for your friends. There's a wonderful book called The Warriors by a man called Glenn Gray, who on the same day in World War II got his PhD in philosophy from Princeton University and his draft papers. And he fought his way across the Pacific. And he says, you know, in warfare, when you're shot at, you're willing to lay down your life for your friends. And so although a war may involve millions of people, it's broken up into very small units, the crew of a submarine, the men in the same trench. And they love each other in a non-sexual way, and they're willing to lay down their lives for each other. And that's something we respect. But it also drives this kind of, well, we simply have to understand it and see if we can't make that faith in other human beings, be more creative.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. In China, I was surprised to read, and maybe I got this wrong, but that the demographics of the country are really aging quite a bit faster than we are, not like the Japanese, but it's really an aging society. And yet we've also know that because of female infanticide, there's a lot of extra males in the society. Can you reconcile those two trends and what it might mean for say the future aggressiveness of China?
Thank you very much. But I go to China quite a lot. I see these parents pushing their one child along in the bassinet. And my mind goes back, I wasn't there, but to the Cultural Revolution. At the time of the Cultural Revolution, you had very rapid population growth. It really was a civil war, and millions of people died. It was extraordinarily painful. I don't think, even if you had somebody as crazy as Chairman Mao in charge of China today, you could have another Cultural Revolution, because you've got the small families and many fewer angry young men. There is an aging society, and you're right that there is an excess of males in some parts of the population, and that's an unfortunate thing. In the 19th century, there was a lot of female infanticide, and those excess males turned into warrior bands that led to a lot of civil wars in China. I think that now, basically, perhaps because there are so few males, even though there are more males than females, that we're not going to have that kind of instability. The Chinese are trying to stop selective abortions before, they're making very sincere efforts. And it's interesting, both in Korea, which also had a lot of desire to have male children, after a decade or so, they've learned to be fairly sensible. And because women are in short supply, they're then saying, well, perhaps it's a good idea to have a daughter. So I think this obscene and very cruel change in the sex ratio is something that may last a few decades in countries, but I don't think it's there forever. But thank you for the question.
Our email address is think@kera.org if you'd like to speak to my guest, Malcolm Potts, whose book is called Sex and War. We have one here from David in Plano who says, I was a little bit surprised by the statement that females have not exhibited the same level of aggression against other females or males. While this may historically be true, how do you explain the excessive amount of violence women perpetrate against themselves, or rather each other, in prison populations or in gang organizations or societies in the U.S.?
Well, all our behavior is a sort of overlapping bell curve. Certainly there are some women that are more aggressive than others and some men that are more pacific than others. But if you look at records for convictions for violent crimes in any part of the world, then men are often 7 or 8 times more common than females in the same age group. Now, there is cultural variation in the Caribbean, where you have many families headed by women where they run in shops and things, you'll have more violent women in prison than you would do in Bangladesh, where women are in purdah and where if they wanted to be violent, it would be very difficult to do it. So the culture interacts. But there's no society where even a third of the crimes, violent crimes, murders, etc., are committed by women. It's very consistent and a profound bit of biology.
Is it possible to compare the biological drive that we, and in particular the men among us, have to acquire territory, to sort of raid other societies or groups, with the biological drive to protect at least one's partner who's bearing one's child, and then the children that come from that union? How are those two things balanced out within the human psyche?
Well, again, this team aggression behavior, which can be so violent, is not a conscious thing. So that I think men in most warrior situations don't necessarily say, I'm going out there to get more territory so I can have more females and put my genes in the next generation.
Right.
They're saying that we hate the enemy. One of the things I think goes with team aggression is an ability to dehumanize or de-chimpanzeeize other people. And we have a terrifying ability to dehumanize other people simply because they've got a different language, or their eyes are a different shape, or their skin is a different color, or they have a different religion. And we all do that. I mean, there was a famous prison experiment in Stanford University in California where young, nice undergraduates were randomly allotted to be prisoners and to be prison guards. And within two or three days, the ones that were playing the game of prison guards were beating up on the ones that had been randomly allotted to be prisoners, rather like Abu Ghraib. And so I think we all have that in us. I was 10 years old at the end of World War II. We just thought the Japanese were chimpanzees. They were horrible medieval people and they deserved an atomic bomb. Now I'm enormously proud to have a Japanese, Iranian, Scottish-American granddaughter. This is California, and many different parents. And it's wonderful, you know, to love people that you could have hated not too long ago in one's own lifetime. And that, I think, is a very personal but vivid example of how we don't have to hate people, and we have to be very, very cautious about this ability to dehumanize other people. We shouldn't go around dehumanizing Muslims or somebody else. Slavery was really part, I think, of this team aggression. Instead of killing people, you dehumanize them and use them for your own perceived benefit.
Is there a genetic basis when you talk about dehumanizing our enemies? Is there a genetic basis for xenophobia?
I think so. Sometimes great writers capture ideas. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel Prize winner, said that evil is something that runs through everybody's heart and who is willing to cut out their own hearts. Mm. And I think that's part of the takeaway message of our book, and it's something that's rather humbling, I think, to us as we were writing the book, that we do have these behaviors, and they're in all of us, but they don't have to be expressed.
Are there audiences that you speak to that find the subject, I'm not talking about people who don't believe that evolution exists, but are there people who find the subject sort of too difficult to consider?
I think so, yes. And I can see that. And certainly it took a long time in my own thinking life, you know, to come to these conclusions. And I think that programs like this help. And I ask people, you know, to try and... I think everybody would agree there's a lot of violence in the world, and I hope everybody would agree that that is a bad thing. So I think trying to get people to look at universal issues in a new way is a useful thing to do. I've certainly found it helpful, and I hope that it's helpful to other people to do that. But you can understand how you have to get over a certain threshold to be able to turn around and look at yourself, to turn around and say, the people who attacked us on 9/11 were a band of warriors who actually thought they were doing something quite brave. Now, what they did was obscene. I'm not trying to excuse it, mm-hmm. but that is the nature of warfare, that our terrorists are somebody else's liberation fighter.
Talk about the particular benefit of putting control over family size in the hands of women as opposed to the hands of couples.
Yes. Well, I find all over the world that if you give women the information and the range of contraceptives they need to have fewer children, then family size falls very rapidly. There's a wonderful example of this in the Islamic Republic of Iran, in that after their very, very destructive war with Iraq, they realized their population was growing so rapidly that even as an oil-rich nation, they couldn't educate and employ all the young people that were coming along. So Ayatollah Khomeini, the theological leader, recognized that the Holy Quran and the sayings of the Holy Prophet are very supportive of family planning. And Iran became the only Islamic nation to have a condom factory to make oral contraceptives. They made family planning available. Everybody that gets married has to go to lessons on contraception. Last time I was in Iran, it was about 5 years ago, there were moral police in the public park making sure young people don't hold hands because it's a very conservative society. Mm-hmm. And yet family size has come down from 6 children on average to 2, more rapidly than China, in a purely voluntary way. And if that can be done in Iran, then I think it could be done in almost any country on this planet. And when I was last in Iran, we drove across the border to Afghanistan. It's a dusty part of the world. In one side, we had a Shiite, Farsi-speaking villagers with 2 children. Go 10 kilometers, we've got Farsi-speaking Shiite villagers that are having 7 children. Hmm. Now, that is simply, I think, access and information. And Afghanistan could have been fundamentally changed in 2001 if, when the Taliban had fallen, we'd gone in there and put, you know, $500 million into helping women. We're spending endless billions fighting a war in Afghanistan, which we are going to lose because, you know, when the Afghans defeated the Brits in the 19th century, there were 4 million. When I first went to Afghanistan in 1970, there were 12 million. When the Afghans defeated the Russians, there were 16 million. Now they're defeating the alliance, they're defeating the Americans, there are 30 million. By 2050, there'll be 50 million. There's no way that anything can be done in that country until we empower women and we empower women to have fewer children. It's a very simple takeaway message. Otherwise, go away from it. There's no way that you could put sufficient troops on the ground in that very, very difficult country to compel people to like you. They're only going to like you as they can get more education and more wealth and get out of this terrible medieval lifestyle.
Can we also look to our biology to explain why countries that are very strong and powerful, like the United States, respond in what some people would say are larger than necessary ways to acts of aggression? And some people might argue that we responded in less aggressive than necessary ways, but talk about that argument.
No, and I mean, if I don't want to get into political arguments, but it's very interesting that families that have daughters are more likely to vote Democratic and families that have sons are more likely to vote Republican. It's a small but statistically important difference. So I think there is an issue here, and that I had a brief conversation with Dick Cheney last year. Very, very civilized person, very intelligent, has had an enormously important post, had a great deal of information, but made basic mistakes about judging whether the Iraqis would like to be invaded. You know, and so we should have been much more careful. We should have understood we cannot make a military response to this asymmetrical warfare where we're dealing. There might have been, you know, a few thousand people in Al Qaeda. Now there's probably about 30,000 people in the Taliban really sort of hating us in Afghanistan. We can't find those people, we can't kill them, we can't round them up. We can only make changes by going upstream and asking, why are they so angry? Why do they want to kill us?
Malcolm Potts is my guest. He is the author of Sex and War, How Biology Explains Warfare and Terrorism and Offers a Path to a Safer World. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is obstetrician, research scientist, and Fred H. Bixby professor at UC Berkeley, Malcolm Potts. His book, written with science journalist Thomas Hayden, is called Sex and War, How Biology Explains Warfare and Terrorism and Offers a Path to a Safer World. You can hear him speak tonight to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Find information about the appearance at dfwworld.org. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Malcolm, we have talked about the situation in Juarez and throughout Mexico with social scientists and with journalists and with experts on the drug trade. I'm curious about what your take is on what is going wrong there.
Well, gangs, whether in Los Angeles or Juarez, again, are young men in this testosterone-filled age group, and they're very loyal to each other. And they're supporting each other, and they're behaving in the same way, and they're hating people that they've dehumanized. They're prepared to kill people that that are getting in their way. I've had some very positive experiences with family planning in Juarez, and I don't want your listeners to think they've got some liberal professor from Berkeley making claims that can't be substantiated. About 30 years ago, we began family planning by getting promotores to distribute pills and condoms to their neighbors in the slums of Juarez. And that went exceptionally well. And it's been very, very successful. Now, if we'd started earlier, we might have had quite as many angry young men around the place to make those differences. But, wherever we do family planning, people are very, very responsive. We started some family planning with Jane Goodall in Western Tanzania, and people was, they were afraid to go to the villages. They said, these are Muslim villages, they're Catholic villages, they won't want to hear about contraception. The villagers said, why didn't you come earlier?
Do the different biological natures of men and women make men more likely to be interested in political service? There's been a lot of discussion about certainly women are equally free in this country to, say, run for Congress or the Senate, and yet they're still dominated by men.
Yes. In the kibbutz in Israel, there was a real effort to bring little boys and girls up in the same way, to give them the same toys, to give women and men the same access to a sort of democratic government. And the men just talked more than the females. If you look at scientific publications, men, if you control for all other factors, make more scientific publications than women, but the women's publications are quoted more frequently. And this is, I think, because, you know, men are competitive and they're going to go out there. Men make very short-term decisions. Women have to make very long-term decisions because having a child and bringing that child to maturity is a long-term investment. If we look at the debacle in Wall Street, it was the testosterone-filled young men in hedge funds who destroyed our economy. If you want to have an investment advisor for your long-term pension funds, turn to a woman, not a man.
So tell me, Malcolm, what is good about testosterone and what it does that humankind could not get along without? We'll leave aside the reproduction of children.
Well, first of all, we all have each other's hormones. You have testosterone, I have estrogen and progesterone, but at different levels. So testosterone is the hormone that drives libido. It drives the sex drive in both sexes. And if sex drive in a loving situation is a very positive thing. I think it makes men competitive, and in some situations that can be successful. And so it's a hormone that it's interesting. If men are castrated, they live longer than if they have intact testicles. And it's this competition that gets overdone. We've really got to rein in that competition but not get rid of it, I think.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Next up, we have Phil in Dallas. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm really enjoying this program.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment. I think to them, that in my experience from legal and law enforcement standpoint, women have taken much stronger role and more passive-aggressive sense as to the actual violence and direction of violence. Where an exorbitant number of cases that I personally dealt with, the men were put up to doing something because of the woman. And I'm not trying to be misogynist, but it's just been my experience.
That's a very interesting experience. Again, going back to Jane Goodall's studies of chimpanzees, for a long time she saw this male violence. You see it if you spend a few hours with chimps. It took her a good many years to realize that the females are also very competitive because that's part of, you know, animal behavior. But they're much more subtle. They make little grunts to each other, and they have little bits of body language. So they're very subtle, but they're understood by the other females. So I think your insight, you know, is a useful one. They are competitive, but they're competitive in different ways and in less destructive ways. And I think your experience, you know, that the women may be putting up the men to be destructive is an interesting one. And I think I'm sure, you know, it's true.
We have an email here from LeRae who writes, Lawrence Wright has commented that a culture that doesn't care what women think is doomed. If this is true, what can be done to cultivate a culture's respect for the thoughts and opinions of women in both private and public spheres?
It's a good question, and I think culture that doesn't respect women is doomed. We can do it through the media. Even people in very poor countries are watching television. In slums, you'll get 15 people paying a few, you know, pennies to watch somebody else's television. The radio gets all over the world, and I think getting messages out there, I think we should invest in the Voice of America and the British Broadcasting Corporation, which people do respect, particularly in you know, semi-corrupt countries like Nigeria, getting information across. And then I think working with women's groups in countries, everywhere I go, I find very, very brave women that are willing to put their lives on the line to help other women. I met an obstetrician in Afghanistan who had been helping to give women safe deliveries when the Taliban was in power. And the Taliban thought that having a midwife was wicked. And they found this woman and they gang raped her. And she still continued to do that work. So I think through USAID and through charities and through non-governmental organizations, building links with those women's organizations and giving them as much support as we possibly can and listening to them. We're not telling people what to do. We're not telling people what to do in relation to family size. We're listening to what women want and trying to help them. And we do have the wealth and the commitment and the skilled people to do that.
And even separate and apart from contraception education, just the general education of women you think is critical?
That makes a huge difference. But the problem is when you've got a very rapidly growing population like Pakistan, then you can't build the schools rapidly enough to keep up. We need 2 million more teachers each year in the developing world just to hold class size constant, not to reduce the level of children not going to school. And we're not training that number. So we have to put much more investment in education. I would certainly do that. And more investment in family planning. Do those two things together and we'll make progress. Either alone is not going to work.
Let's go back to the phones now. Next up, we have Steve in Euless. Hi, Steve.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you very much. Fascinating show. And your guest has been so wonderful in talking about the anthropological and biological roots of our violent tendencies. But my question is about the society's ability to codify and integrate their predilection. I was talking about some religions and also blind nationalism. If you take a look at the Old Testament, my gosh, it's full of genetic cleansing,
yes.
And blind nationalism can lead the whole population astray that God's on our side and we're going to win and we're all together and the heathen. So the cultural aspect as well as the biological aspect, I'd like his opinion on that.
Thanks for
Thank
your call.
You.
You're certainly right about the Old Testament. I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 16, that says you should kill everything that breathes, and the Hittites and the Jebusites should be killed. Wars were traditionally genocidal. That was their purpose. And so I think the other side of the coin is we are making progress. We do try to separate civilians from combatants in modern wars. We do discipline, certainly we would discipline American soldiers if they tried to rape people that they were fighting was taking place. So we've made quite a lot of, I think we made a great deal of progress. And we may be a surprise, but the world's more peaceful now than it's ever been. If you go back, you know, the 17th century, it was split up into small groups that were fighting each other all the time. And we should look at the number of people who get killed in relation to the population base. There were fewer people and there was more violence. So we are making progress. I would like to give an example, Chris, of something which I think validates what I'm trying to say. Your older listeners may remember in 1972 at the Munich Olympics, there was a terrorist group called the Black September, mm-hmm. and they killed a lot of Israeli athletes. They were the typical gang of violent young men that were very angry, who thought they were doing a good and noble thing. Shortly afterwards, Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, knew he could get observer status at the United Nations. And he was very worried that the Black September might do another very dramatic attack on somebody or other, because that would undermine what he was trying to achieve politically. And he knew that he couldn't control these groups directly. A lot of these groups are just people who get together and want to do something bad, like a group of chimpanzees. One of the wiser, older people in the Palestinian, the PLO, said, I know what to do. He said, let's find some young Palestinian girls that are unmarried. Let's take them to Beirut, where the Black September lived. Let's introduce them to these young men. Let's tell them that if they get married, they will get $3,000. If they have a child, they get $5,000. They'll get a flat with a television and a refrigerator. And they did this. And before you could say Cordis Interruptus, Black September had totally collapsed. It never did another violent act at all. They were so surprised by this huge 180 twist around that the PLO actually did experiments. They offered these Black September former terrorists, trips to Geneva to represent the PLO and things. And they said, no, we're not going. We must be on the police list. We've got a family. We've got a wife we love. We've got a child we love. Mm-hmm. We've got a refrigerator and a television. Now, the problem is we can't give all the angry young people in the Middle East or other parts of the world refrigerators and televisions and $5,000. But I think it's a very, very powerful example that people who 1 year can be doing extraordinarily violent, dangerous terrorist acts in our vocabulary, a year later or 2 years later can be just like the rest of us, wanting to build their families, wanting to do safe, responsible things. That change is possible. We know what to do. But what we've got to do is to make the investment upstream in the right place to get all the Black Septembers of the present world to become normal, married, loving couples with children.
I'm curious, Malcolm, about your opinion about the ability or lack thereof of the World Wide Web to forge the kinds of relationships between disparate groups of people that would make them refrain from violence.
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, when 9/11 happened, I must have got 20 emails from my Muslim friends around the world expressing sympathy. Mm-hmm. So I think we can do things. I think we just need to build on that. I have colleagues that are trying to use cell phones to remind people in poor countries when to take an oral contraceptive. I mean, there are lots of things, I think you're absolutely right, that the media can do. It sometimes takes a little bit longer for these new forms of media to sort of really catch hold than we expect. But I think they are going to change the world.
Is there a positive impact to letting young men and little boys do things like play video games? People either say they make them more violent. Other people say that's a great release for something that is an urge that they that sort of comes down from thousands of years of ancestors.
Yes. The answer is I don't know. I mean, I think it's a perfectly good question. I think we should look at it very objectively and do research in that area. I mean, it's a researchable point. I guess that's, if they're not too violent, that those kind of video games are probably quite a good idea.
Anything we haven't talked about that would allow us as the entire human race to tap more deeply into the maternal instinct to protect?
Certainly, again, going back to biology, if you look at chimpanzees, the males inseminate the females. They do nothing to help nurture the young. They tolerate their play. They don't bring them any food. They don't build them any shelters. Certainly in human evolution, we've reached a point where our babies are so large and so helpless that really a woman needs a relationship and a loving relationship with a partner. And I describe us as a polygamous animals, promiscuous animals, struggling to be monogamous. I think anything that would encourage monogamy or at least some attempt at monogamy, I think it's very difficult for polygamous societies, and still a few in the world like Niger, to become democratic. And I think we should do everything we can to promote the rewards of being monogamous between two animals that really have rather different agendas. That men and women are different. I think we need to recognize that. But
I'm afraid that leaves us out of time. Excuse me. Malcolm Potts' book is called Sex and War. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. Malcolm, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.